For members only. Golf Smarter number 182 for the second week of June 2009.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Jesse Ortiz of Bobby Jones Golf answers your questions.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Hey there. Welcome to part two of our conversation with Jesse Ortiz of Bobby Jones Golf. I mentioned last week that we're planning our first Golf Smarter adventure for early September this year, and things are moving along quickly. We should be sending out an email blast, have an additional episode, and provide all the details by next week. I bring it up because, A, I want you to check your calendar for early September to make sure you can join us, and B, I just wanted to assure you that as a Golf Smarter member, you will be offered a reduced rate for this trip. Stay tuned. So I thought Jesse was fabulous last week, and I can't wait to spend more time with him. So, because he was very generous with his valuable time, and yours is valuable too, let's begin. Jesse, thanks again for coming on to Golf Smarter.
No, thanks for having me.
For members only. And, you know, in the last conversation we were having, you mentioned about every golfer is looking for the miracle club, right?
Right.
You created the miracle club a number of years ago with the tri-metal fairway wood and had a tremendous amount of success with that at Orlemar. Is there another miracle club in the horizon with all the millions of dollars that are spent in R&D these days? Or is it hundreds of thousands spent in R&D and millions in marketing?
I think that's closer. That's closer to what it is.
Right? I mean, with all the rules of how far you can take the limits on club design, is there another miracle club out there?
That's tough to say. I didn't know that I created a miracle club 12 years ago. I was the last guy to realize that this thing was so special. You know, I was just making a club that would help the average golfer hit the ball off the fairway. And since I had been working with wood all my life, in a wood club, Fred, in a wood club, it was really a multi-material club. You know, we really coined the term multi-material back in 1997 when tri-metal came out. Up until then, all metal woods were either all stainless steel or all titanium. But with a wood club, you know, you have a persimmon wood, you have a fiber insert, you have a brass sole plate, you have steel screws, you have plastic twine, which was whipping cord. A wood was really a multi-material product, and I didn't have any preconceived notions that a metal wood should be made out of all one material. So when I designed a metal wood, I wanted to move or shift the weight within the club head to certain areas of the club head to make it perform better. And a wood always had a low center of gravity. A metal wood was considered a perimeter weighted club. Before tri-metal, metal woods by all the manufacturers were being touted as perimeter weighted clubs. Well, I knew that perimeter weighting had no place for a fairway wood. You want sole weighting. So when I designed tri-metal, it was combining different metals in one club head to shift the weight. So it would have a sole, it would be sole weighted rather than perimeter weighted. And, I got lucky, and it changed the industry. Today, all the fairway woods on the market are really based on the tri-metal platform. They all have a different face alloy, different alloy steel on the face, and you really don't see many titanium fairway woods on the market today. When tri-metal came out, everyone was trying to push titanium fairway woods because it made sense for drivers. But really, I changed the industry, or maybe I retarded it because I prevented it from making the full swing into titanium, because titanium was just a way to separate the golfer from his money rather than making a better product. So tri-metal really changed the industry. And I don't know if there's another miracle club out there, but we all keep trying to make clubs better. But it's true, Fred. The USGA has really clamped down on what we can do. But it, I keep trying, and my imagination is still as fertile as ever.
Well, that's good. That's good. In part of our conversation earlier this afternoon, when you were giving me the tour and we were looking at clubs and stuff, you were telling me something that I found absolutely fascinating about tour players and their love of their fairway wood. Their, you know, many tour players, you see them wearing hats that have a manufacturer's name on them, so right. You know they're under contract, and they have to use those clubs whether they like them or not. It's a good deal for them. They always say, "Oh, I wouldn't play them unless I, you know, I wouldn't let them be my sponsor unless I love the club."
Right.
But, I don't necessarily buy that all the time. But yeah. we've talked before, and we've heard that whatever their contract is, they get to choose their putter. But
that's
you're saying
right.
There's more than that.
Well, there's more than that. I mean, probably the hardest club in the bag for a tour player to replace is fairway wood. And they go years and years looking for that elusive, perfect fairway wood. A lot of the tour pros, you know, they've got 12 club contracts, and they'll play the manufacturer, the sponsored manufacturer's driver and the irons and the wedges, but they usually have the putter and the fairway wood. They're three wood as they can play whatever they want. It's because it's that critical. And like I said, Fred, once a tour pro finds a fairway wood, a three wood, that they have confidence in the way it looks, the way it sets up, the way it plays, they can control, you know, the ball flight. They don't give it up. It doesn't matter who their sponsor is. They've got that fairway wood in the bag for years and years and years.
It's really interesting. What do you think the biggest mistake that most recreational golfers, I'm using the term that you use, recreational golfers, the average golfer, the weekend golfer, makes in selecting a fairway wood? What's the biggest error in judgment that they have?
Probably the biggest is not selecting a fairway wood with enough loft. They go out and they say, well, I need a three wood. And usually they, you know, you go into a shop and they say, well, here are our three woods. And they can vary from 13 degrees to 15, maybe 16 degrees. Most golfers believe that if a fairway wood has more than, you know, 15 degrees, it's like a five wood. The key for the average golfer is to get the ball airborne consistently off the deck, off the fairway with their fairway wood. And if it takes an extra couple of degrees, so be it. So loft is critical. And I think most golfers don't go with enough loft. And number two...
Is that an ego thing?
It's an ego thing.
Okay.
It's just like golfers using shafts that are too firm for them. Hmm. The other big mistake with fairway woods that the average golfer makes is they buy fairway woods that just don't look right to them. In other words, they're big heads, they're deep-faced. Most of the fairway woods on the market have deep faces on them, and they're great off the tee, but they're lousy off the fairway. You've got to get a fairway wood.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you know, I saw what you did with your hand, but obviously the audience.
Right.
When you say deep-faced, what does that mean?
Well, from the cord line or from the bottom of the club, go vertically up the center of the face to the top of the face, not the top of the crown, but to the top of the face. So you just measure that face area, and you know our faces tend to be about, our fairway woods are about 31 millimeters. Most of the clubs on the market, most of the fairway woods on the market are 35 and deeper. And like I said, Fred, that's good if you're going to use a fairway wood off the tee, but it really works against you in the fairway. And most of the tour pros are actually using fairway woods that are older because they like the smaller heads. That's how Tri-Metal came about, is I knew that the manufacturers were pushing titanium fairway woods, but none of their players on tour were using titanium fairway woods. They were using that company's old steel metal woods, fairway woods. And so I knew that a shallower face is going to promote, it's going to give you a deeper, it's a shallow face, excuse me, it's going to give you a lower center of gravity. It's also going to give you more confidence when you're setting up to the ball. And when you have more confidence, you're going to put a better swing. So really, you've got to get a fairway wood that has a little bit extra loft. Don't be afraid to get a fairway wood that's got 16, even 17 degrees. Okay? Like a 3.5 or 4 wood. Get rid of the 3 wood. Go to a 3.5 or 4 wood, and you'll see that you're going to hit the ball higher, more consistently, and you're going to get it further down the fairway than trying to muscle up on a 13 or 14 degree 3 wood that you really have no chance to get off the deck.
Mm. One of the things when you were talking about in the creation of the tri-metal and the redistribution of weight, there's products now on the market that allows the consumer to change the weighting of the club as they use it in different instances, obviously before they get onto the golf course. Is that a good thing for the consumer to have, or does that just make things more confusing, more complicated for them?
In my opinion,
for your opinion,
in my opinion, Fred, it's a little bit of both. I think that if you have a tendency to leave the ball out to the right, you should take a look at a club that has a face that with a slightly closed face, so it's pointing a little bit to the left. But you want also a club that has a little bit more weight in the heel. Once you make that adjustment, though, I think that's where it ends. You shouldn't be, in other words, you shouldn't be weight jockeying and saying, gee, you know, I'm playing this course next week. I'm going to change the weight of the club and move the screws here, you know, up to the toe rather than to the heel. Gee, I'm going to go to another place. I'm going to move it again. I think you overanalyze the situation there and it works against you. So that part gets confusing. But once, I think to be able to adjust the weights to how you generally play, once, the first time, that's fine. But after that, then I think it works against you and you start getting psyched out.
Yep. And then it gets in your head.
Once it gets into your head,
you're done.
You're dead.
All right. As we talked about for this show and build it, it's going to be questions that we've received from listeners of Golf Smarter Podcast. And we've got a lot of wedge questions. I mean, that is something that comes up. I definitely get more questions about wedges than I do about drivers.
That's good, because like we were talking before, when you go to the driving range, everyone's hitting drivers. They're
that's
not
right.
hitting wedges.
They're not hitting wedges, and it doesn't make sense. And why do they do that? Well, because they want to see the ball travel far.
That's right.
What is it about that? Seeing a ball travel through the air, watching a home run.
That's right.
You know, seeing a long bomb thrown downfield. You just want to see a ball flying. But here's one from Ken Kishihara of Fresno, right here in California. He says, I'm a Titleist wedge guy, and this time my wedges are looking a little worn. He wants to know, does it matter what metal manufacturers use, and does it really make a difference on how it feels?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question that the softer the metal, the better the club is going to feel. Now, all of the wedges, whether it's a Titleist or a... Almost all the forged wedges are made out of a very soft carbon steel. So they'll feel the same, but the chroming can be a little different. And the chrome, you have to chrome the carbon steel heads, otherwise they rust. So depending on the type of chroming and how thick it goes on, that can also affect the feel. But pretty much all forged wedges should feel the same if the metal is the same. There's heat treat processes, so sometimes it comes out a little softer than one brand comes out a little softer than others. But definitely the hardness of the metal, or in this case, the softness of the metal, does affect the feel. No question about it.
Interesting. And with the grooves being at the maximum limit, does it really scuff up premium balls badly on a full wedge shot?
Well, that's an interesting question, because pretty much every manufacturer has square grooves. And the square grooves, I don't care what you call them, some of them on the market have nicknames. A square groove is pretty much a square groove. So if you take it to the limit, everyone's grooves are the same. What is different is the edge of the groove. What comes in contact with the ball isn't the square groove. It's the edge of the groove, or the radius where it comes up to the face and actually grabs the ball. In other words, the groove, Fred, only channels water away from the face. So a square groove will channel water away faster than a V groove. Okay? But the groove doesn't really affect the grab on the ball. It just displaces the water, which gives you a better opportunity, or it gives you a better friction on the edge of that groove. I don't know if, am I making sense there?
I don't know how to, I apologize, but I don't understand where water came into this conversation.
Well, you got to realize that grass is what? 90% water?
Oh, okay. Okay.
So when you're in kind of rough and you're hitting out of the rough, or even a normal shot out of the fairway,
you hit down on it.
Okay. You know, yeah, you're pinching down, but eventually the grass is going to come between the ball and the face of the club. So when the grass gets compressed, the water is whisked away quicker from the face when you have a square draft groove, or, you know, square groove. It channels the water away quicker than a V groove.
Interesting.
So that's why the square grooves have become so popular, because they move the water away from the face quicker. The problem is that then you're still left with, when the ball comes in contact with the face, it's really coming in contact with the edge of the groove, or the radius. And when you have a forged wedge and you've used it for a while, it starts to wear very quickly, and now you're losing spin. And when you lose spin, you lose control.
Interesting. Okay. Now, I've heard many people say, oh, it's a good thing that your wedges are getting rusty. Myth or fact?
Myth. Again, what happens is that all rust is the deterioration of the surface of the metal. Okay, so yes, it does get a little bit more porous, so you could argue, well, there's a little more friction, and that's good. But the problem is after you've hit a few shots, that the surface that is rusted is also much softer and deteriorates quicker than a non-rusted surface. So yes, maybe for a shot or two, you get a little bit more spin, but after you've hit a few shots, the rust has actually worn away the edge of the score line, and you're going to get less spin.
Interesting. Now, here's a question that we kind of touched on this in our last conversation. This one comes from Ryan Kudrowski of Bella Vista, Arkansas. And this is a perfect question for you, because, again, your Pels wedges addresses this. Should you have the same grip on your wedge as the rest of your clubs, or is it better to have a smaller or larger grip?
That's right in my wheelhouse.
I'm tossing up softballs, babe.
But they're really good questions. You really should have a larger
grip.
Because
they're someone else's question, not mine.
You should have a larger grip on your wedges. And fits right in with Dave Pels's philosophy. The larger grip is going to prevent you from getting quick with the hands. The last thing you want to do is get handsy with the wedges. What you want to do is neutralize the hands, kind of like in putting. You know, make it, especially with chip shots, let the club do the work. And the smaller grip is going to get you handsier. Some people prefer smaller grips on their irons because they feel that it gives them a little bit more control. But definitely on your wedges, you want your grips to be a bit bigger so that it neutralizes the hands and you don't get quick and chili dip. Just let the bigger grip kind of just neutralize the hands, and use your shoulders kind of to chip, kind of like the putting motion. You know, when you putt, Fred, you know, you got the triangle, your two shoulders and your hands together. There's a lot, you know, we were talking before where golfers are going to these very, very extra large grips on putters so that they have like a triangular pendulum. You know, you've got, you're rotating your shoulders and your hands don't move much on a putt. Same thing with your wedges. A bigger grip will help your chipping, and it'll help your half shots, you know, from 50 yards and in.
Thank you. And Ryan, thanks for the question. Jason Palmer, this one's from Australia. Abbotsford, Australia.
He must be a lefty.
Only when the water's going down in the opposite direction. He wants to know about getting another wedge. He says that I currently have a pitching wedge and a sand wedge that came as part of this standard set of irons that he purchased. Should he replace those clubs that he already has, or is he better off adding to the bag and getting either a gap or a lob wedge?
Absolutely. And that's another great question.
These are not dummies, these people who listen to the show. I want you to know this.
A lot of golfers, Fred, don't realize that they're hurting their short games if they only have a pitching wedge and a sand wedge. And the reason for that is that 25 years ago or so, in the old days, a pitching wedge had 50 degrees. And your sand iron had 56. Well, when cavity back designs came into play and graphite shafts came into play and the hype of the golf world came into play, what we did as manufacturers is we lowered the center of gravity on irons. We made them half inch longer. We juiced up the lofts. Okay. So what happened is now you could hit the ball higher and further, and that we named technology. We strengthened the loft of the iron. We lowered the center of gravity because of the cavity backs, so you could get the ball higher, further. So now what happened is your 5-iron, okay, had a 4-iron loft on it. Everything got juiced up. So from a 3-iron to your pitching wedge, all the lofts got stronger by almost one club. Today, and then the question that he's asking here, today's pitching wedge is about 46 or 47 degrees. The old pitching wedge, going back 25 years ago when we were starting to play golf, that was a 50-degree wedge. So we juiced everything up to tell you that, hey, you're hitting the ball further and this is great technology. But the one club we couldn't make stronger was the sand wedge. Because if we took the sand wedge and went from 55, 56 down to 51 or 52, you wouldn't be able to get it out of the trap. So what happened is your pitching wedge became a 9-iron. Your sand iron stayed the same. And now you have what's known as a gap. And you have a gap in a critical distance. Because today's pitching wedges for most guys will go about 110 yards, 115 yards. But their sand iron still only goes with the full shot maybe about 75 or 80 yards. So you're in this no man's land of what do I do when I'm 100 yards away from the green? And you either back off on the pitching wedge or you swing from the seat of your pants on your sand iron. And gee, you're missing more greens. But wow, I got this 460cc driver. I got these wonderful hybrids. I got all this stuff and I'm not scoring any better. Well, you're not scoring any better because you're still in the twilight zone at 100 yards and in. So that question is great. You could do one of two things. You can either get rid of your pitching wedge and sand and go in and get a new pitch gap and sand wedge that match up together, or keep the two that you got now or that he has now and slip in a 52-degree wedge, take a 3/4 swing with it, and he'll have the perfect club that gets him 100 yards, and he'll improve and get his game.
Yeah, for the recreational golfer, the 3/4 swing concept, to me, is more of a concept than an execution. You know, it's like,
yes, it is.
You know, trying to just get a consistent swing, and now I got to change it because I can't go back all the way, or I have to slow it down even more. That's really hard to do.
When
you're not playing 8 hours a day, 7 days a week.
That's true. But I think if the average golfer just put it in his mind, saying, gee, you know, those guys on the tour, they swing so easy.
Yeah.
You know, they look like they're hardly swinging, they're hitting the ball. You know, what the average golfer doesn't realize is they're making full shoulder turns. They're not swinging that hard, but they move their shoulders and their hands go up a much higher than the average golfer. If the average golfer could just visualize the tempo of the tour pro and take his hands to the 10:30 or 11 o'clock position, take it to 3/4, but swing, imagine the tempo of the tour pro, they would do a lot better. Mm-hmm. The reason the tour pro is hitting the ball so far, most of them, when you exclude Tiger, because he does swing hard. But most of the tour pros, they're just so loose that they've got a shoulder turn that we can only dream of. And so they've turned their shoulder. They've moved their hands so far behind them, and the shoulder turn is so strong, you know, so great that they don't have to swing hard because they've created arc they've created the arc naturally by rotating their shoulders. They don't have to swing hard, where normally the average golfer doesn't turn as much, so he has to swing harder to get distance. And I think what they should do is just swing three quarters, make good contact, and they'll realize that they're getting virtually the same distance as when they swing really hard and catch it.
All right, now let me get out my questions here about yoga and how to get more flexibility and a better more turn. Yeah, that's not going to happen. You know, I recently saw some video of myself and realized what an arm swinger I am, that I don't really get around. I don't get a big turn on the
you
ball.
You think you do.
I thought I did, and I saw a video and I was like, oh, look at that. I'm just, it's all my arms. I don't get my shoulder around at all, hardly at all. But and it's like, okay, golfers, I have started doing yoga on a daily basis.
Most golfers, Fred, that's the thing. If they saw a video of themselves, they'd think that, gee, you know what? I've got a full swing. No, what they have is a three-quarter swing already, but then they break their wrists at the top to get the club somewhat parallel, and that's when they lose control of where the club head is. So they take a three-quarter swing, they break their wrist, you know, way up at the top, so they think that they're parallel. No, they're not parallel. They're three-quarters. They've broken the wrist. Now they start casting, and they've lost all control. Just try not to break the wrist so much, except your three-quarter turn, because you're not really a full turn, and make good contact and you'll improve your game.
Yeah, I mean, even if you watch John Daly, how he gets around that belly, how he's able to make that turn, it's remarkable.
He's not in great shape, but he's got great shoulder turn. All those guys on tour, they really rotate those shoulders.
Unbelievable. You talked about it became technology. Right.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because watching you here and hearing you talk about getting started as a kid and what you've been through, and you're a craftsman. This is a craft for you. But today, those people who are working at the big manufacturers are engineers.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. And they know how to make a golf club perform, but they really don't know how to make a golf club that looks good. They don't know what a golf club should look like. They can move the weight around. They can tell you, you know, what the COR is going to be or the CT of the face is going to be and all that. But there's something that I believe is still important in the game, and that's the connection between the club head, the shaft, the hands, the whole package. When you put a club down, it's got to look like it's your friend. It's got to look like you can hit it.
An old friend.
You got confidence, and that you're not thinking about, gee, how the club's going to look. Do I got to move the face around this way or that way? You're just concentrating on the shot. And, you know, I'm old school. I was raised, you know, I've said, Fred, that I've ruined more clubs than Jack Nicklaus has ever seen, because in the old days, you know, there were over 100 steps into making a Woodwood, and if any one of them was done wrong or incorrectly, that club became firewood. So you learn very quickly how to not make mistakes, and you learn how to shape a club to the eye of a golf professional. There's certain things that they still look for. And I take a lot of pride that I'm one of the few guys left from the old persimmon era that's making metalwoods. But yeah, it's sometimes intimidating to know that all these guys are engineers, but then you know, that all goes out the window when I see the pros and the great players using my stuff. You know, I guess there still is room for the old school there when you got pros using my products.
That's fabulous. And is that why I'm assuming that the Bobby Jones Foundation, the group, came to you and said, we want your craftsmanship on this name?
Yeah,
is that how that worked?
Yeah, the Jones family wanted the name on some golf clubs. And there were several big companies that wanted to get the name. But the family was concerned about something that was going to look like some rocket ship. And it just didn't have the tradition of the name. And when I hooked up with them, that was one of there were a lot of talks about that. And it was very important that the clubs have all the high-tech advantages of any other club on the market. I mean, we wouldn't be anywhere here, Fred, if my driver was 20 yards shorter, but boy, it really looked beautiful. You know, it's got to be right up there with all the high-tech clubs, but it had to have a thread. It had to have a soul. The clubs had to have a traditional soul to them, and I think that's what these clubs have. They look pure.
And the word soul could be two different things here. We're talking S-O-U-L.
I'm talking S-O-U-L.
There you go. I want to make sure.
That's right.
And you're not in Carlsbad, California. You're in an industrial park in Hayward, California. I mean, this is not traditional golf industry setting.
No, but then, you know, this is where Tri-Metal was born. This is where my dad started Orlemar back in 1960. This is where Tony Lima and Ken Venturi would come, and Tom Weisskopf and Palmer and a lot of the golfers from the 60s would come here. Johnny Miller would come. You know, he was a Northern Cal kid. You know, you don't have to go to Carlsbad to have imagination. You know, we were craftsmen here, and this is where I came up with Tri-Metal. Was up here in Northern California, which I'm sure rankled a lot of the people in the golf industry. How can some hillbilly in the middle of Northern California come up with some multi-material club that changes the industry? I mean, aren't all these ideas coming from Carlsbad? Aren't we spending millions and millions of dollars here in think tanking to produce clubs? Well, you know, if you've got imagination and you've got hunger in the stomach and you've got a passion for what you do, sometimes you get lucky. And and I got lucky with Tri-Metal,
we have 12 month a year golf here too.
Pretty much, although you and I are pretty much fair weather golfers, Fred. So
that's a nice way to put
think
it.
You
I call
and
it
I'll
a weather wimp.
Yeah, we're weather wimps. We're not going to be out playing in January.
But. No. Something kind of controversial that's crossed the Golf Smarter audience path, and that is Gary George of North Bay, Ontario, Canada, wrote in and said, what do you really think of single-length golf irons, those sets that are all the same length?
I don't...
Are you familiar with them?
I don't know if they're making a comeback now. I know that there was a company many, many years ago. I believe it was Sounder back in the early 70s. Again, Fred, I'm a dinosaur. I'm dating myself. But that concept of one-length irons came out, I know.
I think it was
about
a Tommy Armour.
35 or 4 years. Then there was a Tommy Armour one that came out about a decade after that. I don't know who's making them now.
There's a small company that is making them now, and we've had conversations with them.
You know, I think it might have some merit for some golfers. You know, the two things that determine distance are loft and length of shaft. Loft of the head or the face and the length.
Does the length really dictate as much as the loft?
They are about equal.
Really?
That's why if you look at your irons, they're all in half-inch increments.
Right.
That way they give you about 15 yards difference. Why? Because if you had a club that, if you had a 5 and a 6 iron and they were both the same length, shaft length, there would probably be about 7 yards difference between the two of them when you hit them. Now, I'm talking about a 5 and a 6 iron where there is 3 degrees difference in the loft of the club. 3, sometimes 4. Some manufacturers put 4 degrees difference between each iron. Others put 3. Okay? But if you were to take a typical 5 and 6 iron that have about 3 or 4 degrees loft difference, and you made them the same length, they would be about 7, 8 yards difference, okay? Now, if you cut one, you take the 6 iron and you cut it half an inch shorter, your arc is shorter or smaller, or your arc is shorter. So that reduces the distance. That now gives you your roughly 10, now your 15 yards difference between a typical 5 iron and a 6 iron. Okay, 10 to 15 yards is about the difference there. So, you know, for some, I would say for golfers that don't have much difference in distance between their irons, a concept like that could make sense and they could control the ball better.
Because, you know, one of the arguments
possibly
for
seniors.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the arguments for this is for the recreational player who's not that skilled, that if they can take their favorite club, you know, what's your favorite club in your bag? Let's say it's your 6-iron.
Right.
And if you go from your 6-iron to your 9-iron, it's a shorter shaft, so you're going to have to change your arc. You're going to have to change your swing somewhat. But if you had a club that you were very comfortable with, that you can have the same swing with every club.
Right. If I could see it, Fred, if it was someone who currently has a set of, say, 4 through pitch, and the difference between each iron is 5 or 6 yards. You know, a lot of women have, women, golfers with slower swing speeds, they really don't get a true 12 or 15 yard gap between each iron.
And that's the optimum distance between
each
iron?
That's the optimum
distance. That's what you're looking for.
Yeah, about 12 to 15 yards between each iron.
Okay.
That's what it is.
Okay. Well, then it's interesting because the next question that comes from Clayton Brown in Birmingham, Alabama, he said that he's heard us talk about the bounce and wedge personalization, which he thought was very helpful, and he noted that he never buy a wedge without trying it first.
I would agree with that.
Okay. We've said that on the show before. But here's his issue. He's 6'5", and all of his irons are 1 inch extended.
That's right.
When he's trying a standard length wedge, even to hit it just once, it's typically a disaster for him.
That's right.
So I don't feel that there are many demo clubs with extended shafts for me to try. So what should a tall person like that do?
That's just one of the tough things in life when you're gifted with being that tall. You know,
gifted. Okay,
yeah, you're gifted to be. Yeah, you're gifted if you're. What is he? 6'5"?
Yeah,
that's a gift.
And playing golf.
That was a gift. You know, unfortunately, there's some downside, and this is a problem because most of the time, it's virtually impossible for him to find a wedge off the rack that's going to be an inch or an inch and a half longer, and what he really needs is something that's going to be 2-3 degrees, maybe even 4 degrees upright. Also, because that then gets the grip up closer to his hands. He's got a problem. And the only thing he could do is hopefully order a wedge from a company that stands behind the product. And I'm not going to start chilling here, Fred. But, you know, try it out. I mean, we get people here who we do a lot of 1 inch over clubs, inch and a half over. For him, I'd probably recommend even going to a graphite shaft, because once you go inch and a half longer on wedges, the heads get pretty heavy, and that's also a detriment to someone who's that tall. So, you know,
you rarely see graphite shaft on a wedge.
Very rarely. But, you know, if you're talking,
and is it a good idea? Generally,
no.
Okay.
But if he's a relative, but, you know, we have some graphite shafts that have very low torque. And the downside to having a graphite shaft, or the disadvantages, Fred, are usually far outweighed by having a club that is the proper length for him. So, yeah, is he, you know, a 1 inch over steel, he may hit a 2 inch over graphite shaft much better than the 1 inch over steel. So, you know, again, he really should try something out like that. Because the length is going to help him more than the fact that it's steel or graphite. He needs something that's long enough for him.
Okay, Clayton, there you go. Kenny Armour from Indianapolis, Indiana, sent in a question that we almost addressed, but he's really concerned about this. He's able to hit his 8-iron 2 out of 3 times just as far as his 6-iron. And he's baffled by it. I thought I noticed that my 8-iron going further than my 7 in the past, but thought it was just a fluke. Today I hit over 30 shots with my 8-iron, and there was a target green that I was occasionally reaching with my 6-iron that I was able to hit with my 8-iron with about the same frequency. How can this happen, and what should I do?
First place is check the lofts of all the clubs, mm-hmm. because his 6-iron may be weaker than normal, and his 8-iron may be stronger. You know, there should be about 7 or 8 degrees difference between his 6-iron and his 8-iron. It may be that they're not set right. So that's number one. Number two, kind of where we were going with our drivers with you earlier in the day, Fred, and with your fairway wood, that you get sometimes you get more distance through the air than you do on the ground. The 8-iron is a little shorter. He's probably more comfortable with that length. He's probably making better contact in the middle of the face with the 8-iron than he is with the 6-iron. 6-iron, he's probably not catching flush. He's maybe missing the sweet spot, because it's tougher to hit the sweet spot on a 6-iron than it is on an 8-iron. So,
because the shaft is longer?
The shaft is longer, A. Less loft, mm-hmm. B. So, you know.
So, should he get some tape and put it on both of those clubs on the face of the
That would be
a
good idea to see where he's hitting. Really hitting the ball. I mean, yeah, just because you got a 6-iron. Let me put it this way. The law of physics is going to say that what he is experiencing is impossible, because there's no way that a 6-iron at a true 6-iron loft and at 1 inch longer than his 8-iron should be, with a lot less loft, should be going the same distance. So the factors are: check to see what the loft is truly on the 6 and what it is on the 8.
And how can he do that? How can he check the...
He should take it into any local pro shop, and they'll set them up. Everyone's got loft and lie machines. Go in there. Don't just check those two clubs. He ought to have the whole set checked. Make sure that there's 3 to 4 degrees difference in loft between each one of his irons, okay? Make sure that those they're gapped properly. And then put the face, like put tape on the face. I'll bet you he's hitting his 8-iron more in the center of the face than with the 6-iron. And again, that's only natural. The longer the shaft, the tougher it is to hit the center of the face. That's why we make giant driver heads, because you're 45 inches away or 46 inches away.
That are more forgiving.
It's more forgiving.
Yeah, interesting. All right, last one. You've been awesome. I really appreciate you spending so much time.
No, this is kind of fun.
Good. Well, we can do this more often. This one from Seoul, Korea.
Wow.
Another spelling of Seoul.
Okay.
S-E-O-U-L. He says he's only been playing for a couple years, and he shoots to low to mid-90s, but it's getting his swing reworked by a local Korean PGA pro. Should he get fitted for clubs now, or wait a couple years until he gets his own swing worked out?
Every day that he's using clubs that are not fit to him is a day that he's not optimizing his ability to score well. I just believe that I can't believe that he's going through such a radical change that the clubs that he would be fitted for today could not be adjusted down the road. All the irons can be bent a little bit more upright or flat, and they can be adjusted for loft also. If he's moving to a steeper swing plane or a flatter swing plane, that's going to affect the trajectory. But that can all be adjusted in the irons later on. So I would say, you know, he's done darn well to take up the game in 2 years and be in the low 90s.
Yeah.
I think he's got enough game now that any changes he makes are not going to hurt hurt the equipment that he's going to be that he could be fitted for right now. I would say go get fitted now and start enjoying playing better.
Absolutely. And that was John Kim of Seoul Korea.
That's a great question, because he probably got a starter set when he first, you know, started playing.
Yeah.
And now
now that he's hooked
and he's in the low 90s, you know, it's again, most of his scoring, most of his game is going to improve now from about 125 yards and in. That's how you get from the mid-90s to the low 80s, is really to be improving your short game. So, you know, that can easily be adjusted later on. The clubs can be bent. He should go out and get fitted right now.
Absolutely. Jesse Ortiz, Bobby Jones Golf, BobbyJonesGolf.com. Correct?
BobbyJonesGolf.com.
A lot of really interesting information, bunch of video on there as well. You'll even see the room that we're in right now doing this interview. You'll even see shots of that, because I walked in and went, I've seen this place before.
That's right. It's on the infomercial. You get a little, get some of that.
Yeah, infomercial stuff work for you?
Yeah, it does. It's worked very well. It gives us a chance, Fred, to really tell the story in 30 minutes. And you know, there's so much hype in the business that for us it works well, because I get a chance to tell the story in my own voice, which is important. You know, I don't have the big marketing budget the big guys got. I just got kind of what I know. So we got to go with what we got.
And we can provide you the audience to talk directly to them and have an ongoing communication. Jesse, thanks so much for this. This has been awesome.
Thanks for spending the time here. It's been great.
Okay, he thinks it's great. Well, he's my new hero. That's all there is to it. Hopefully you were entertained and educated as much as I on these last two episodes with Jesse Ortiz. Now let's gang up on him. If his IT and marketing people see that we have an active and interested audience, we may be able to get Jesse to come on the show regularly to answer more questions like these. Look, you and I have a different kind of relationship than the normal podcast audience, so I'm going to be absolutely frank with you. I spend a lot of my time each week looking for an expert to represent either a golf retailer or a manufacturer to provide the show with sponsorship support, discounts and prizes for you, and authoritative answers. If you've been listening to Golf Smarter for a while, or have heard Golf Better podcast when I was hosting it, you know how much fun it is to have someone to play with on a regular basis. I miss Kenny, but he ain't coming back. So please click on the Bobby Jones Golf ad at golfsmarter.com to prove that we do generate traffic from this podcast. Jesse is smart, articulate, and I think would love to do this. It sounded like he was having fun with us, right? But we've got to prove that this show can generate some interest in his company. All right, this is a members-only episode, which means I'm giving something away. Today's winner will receive the latest in iron protection technology, a 10-piece cover set of snug neoprene iron head covers courtesy of Iron Armor. Check them out at ironarmor.com. It's ironarmour.com, and it will be in the blog and show notes if you need to check. Congratulations, Golf Smarter member Derek Zazko of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hopefully you're a walker, Derek, because not only will your clubs be protected from unnecessary scratches from the abuse they take while banging into each other, but while you're walking the course, you'll notice how much quieter the walk will be without all that clanging going on behind you. I discovered Iron Armor because it's the creation of a Golf Smarter listener, so it's in the family. Help support them too. That's ironarmor.com. Today's quote was submitted by Aaron Billman, a Golf Smarter member who will be coming up to see the American Century Celebrity Golf Championships at Edgewood Tahoe. It's not a far drive for him, so he was happy to get these tickets. And the quote is this, and probably something you'll use frequently. Have you ever noticed that everyone replaces a divot after a perfect approach shot? Next week, NBC Sports reporter Jimmy Roberts talking about his new book, Breaking the Slump. I welcome your comments, suggestions, requests, and quotes. We have many ongoing discussions at our Golf Smarter group on Facebook. Or if you want to talk to me, just send me an email by scrolling over the feedback tab to select Hey Fred at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. delivering sound advice.